got a 1 o'clock class, but I need...
Okay, you need to prepare. Okay, so we'll just do... Okay. So, hi, we're here with Michael Collins in the Department of English at Georgetown, and it's June 1st, and Professor Collins was my professor for a Shakespeare course last year. So, Michael, here's the question. As we heard at that conference last year, why dork around with books? Why should people read these great canonical texts? Students, adults like me, anyone out in the world. Mm-hmm. Why would you?
One answer that the Department of English might give you to that question is this. We become better readers, better writers, and better critical thinkers as a result of reading, analyzing, and ultimately writing about texts. And therefore, all those skills are translatable to the workplace. So you can major in English, and then you have the skills that the workplace will welcome, so you can have your cake and eat it too. And although that's a perfectly plausible and I think rational, sensible reason, it doesn't seem to me to be the deepest reason. I think the reason we should be reading books, thinking about them, reflecting on them, writing down our reflections in essays, is because in some way books, great texts, whether novels, poems, plays, give us entry into the human condition, helps us to understand what it means to be human, or at least to find an answer to that question that makes sense for ourselves. Find then ultimately from that the answer to that question perhaps a way of living our lives well. That's Socrates' word, not mine, living well. And then also to understand that we are not simply isolated individuals living our lives by ourselves or in a particular historic period, but we are connected both to the past and to the future. And I think we become better people as a result of that. Not necessarily morally better people, but we become, although that's the hope, we become more fully human. And by being more fully human, we become better workers, better citizens, and ultimately better human beings. So I would say that what we would want on the job, most skills that you need on the job, you can be trained on the job for them. What you can't be trained is to see the world in a humane way. To Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic, says, you know, what we need is some recognition of spirit, conscience, of something that just goes beyond the skills and the techniques that we need on the job to really create a good society and to live a satisfying life. We need something more. And I think it's the humanities that give us some possibility of finding for ourselves that something more.
That's something more, yeah. So it's interesting because I think there's a temptation, as you said at the beginning, the standard English department answers to connect it to the workplace. And I'm all for that. I mean, I think, you know, in an era of budget cuts and, you know, it's very good to be practical and to think of, you know, and in the profoundly anti-intellectual environment in which we find ourselves in 2016, it's very good to be able to justify funding departments and degrees. But I'm also interested in the non-practical explanation, the idea of being a better citizen. Better citizens can make educated judgments about political candidates. And there's a word that comes up a lot, which is empathy. You know, when you read in the newspaper headlines about six-year-olds shooting three-year-olds, and this, you know, public schools are now doing courses in character, which at first seemed laughable to me, the idea that you can teach character. I just thought character is something you get in the ether with your breakfast cereal. But maybe you can. Now I'm sort of coming around. Maybe, you know, you can teach character. And is reading great books or any book at all and acquiring empathy through reading, is that a way? Dan Marshalek, who's in our program, who, you know, he's always very, I mean, he's doing this literature track in the med school, and he keeps saying to me, oh, that word empathy, it's so overused. I'm like, okay, but if it's not empathy you're trying to teach these doctors, then what is it?
Imagination. Same thing, to be able to go out of yourself and to imagine, not simply the other, as we say, but to imagine it, to imagine situations, to imagine possibilities, to be able to think imaginatively. If you want creatively, that's okay, but to think imaginatively. The most important thing, well, one of the results, I think, of studying the humanities is that one's imagination grows more powerful, becomes empowered in ways it would not otherwise be.
So you're not in your narrow little sort of,
yes,
solipsistic,
to imagine beyond, and not just in terms of kind of empathy, where you imagine the plight of another. Although that's
good. I'm not putting it down, but
the also imagination in the to see possibilities, to see, you know, at the end of As You Like It, the clown Touchstone says, you know, much virtue in if you can imagine something, if you can. And that's what literature is. It's all if.
The idea of uncertainty, uncertainty, potentiality, liminality, to use that popular word.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It's also somebody has imagined this world, and the reader enters into it, and his or her own imagination grows more effective.
Supple, flexible,
whatever word you
right.
want to put
very
in there.
Interesting. Yeah. So I have one final question, because I know we're running out of time, but about what those great books are exactly. I mean, there are lots of great books like Machiavelli's The Prince. I'm actually sort of narrowing my scope a little bit to literature, poems, plays, novels. Not that Machiavelli isn't great, but that's another part of the humanities in my mind. And I guess during my time at Georgetown, and even way back when I was an undergraduate, there's this question of the canon, which fascinates me. When I was younger, I sort of rejected the canon, although even then I had questions. You know what, I think I've said this to you and I've said this to others here. To me, the point is not to throw out the, you know, by now it's such a trite phrase, the dead white men, but to read them with another lens, the lens of feminism or queer theory or whatever lens you want, but to read them and not throw them out. And then a high school English teacher who is an African-American woman who was teaching Zora Neale Hurston, and she came to speak to a class that I brought her in last year for Eddie Maloney's class, and she said, here's the problem I was faced with. I was given free rein to add Hurston, to add whatever I wanted to these canonical texts. This is at Georgetown Day School, so it's a, you know, very sophisticated curriculum for high school. She said, but I had to choose. And she's a fan of the canon, but she said, I had to choose something to go. So I dropped Dickens. And I said, oh, that's too bad. And she said, I felt the same way. And the class used to read Moby Dick years ago, and now they don't. Well, after my 2 years at Georgetown, it seems the only canonical text here, that the only shared sort of literature that the students in the MA program at Georgetown read, is Toni Morrison and Junot Diaz. I actually loved Junot Diaz and defended him wildly in a class against charges that he was a misogynist. I thought he's great. I really love him. I love Toni Morrison. But Trollope, Thackeray, who else? I'm trying to think of who isn't read? Trollope and Thackeray, you can search.
Dickens.
James. No, Dickens is read here.
Yeah.
Dickens is read
here.
That's right. But I'm looking for people who aren't read here. Trollope, you could search high and low for a Trollope class. Thackeray. James.
Henry James.
James, of all. I mean, Trollope and Thackeray, okay, you can say, maybe so. But James?
George Eliot, I don't
know. No, George Eliot? No, George Eliot. I mean, now, some of that's the function of, okay, you have professors who have certain interests and they want to teach, you know, your Shakespeare is your thing, your jam, as they say these days. But, you know, so you're going to teach Shakespeare, of course, and John Ford Richards is going to teach Dickens. Okay. But the graduates of this program are going to all, without a doubt, have read at least one Junot Diaz text. What happens to Trollope? What happens to Thackeray? This is one of my questions.
That's an extraordinarily difficult question to answer and to deal with in practical terms. As you say, people want to teach what they want to teach, and most people these days don't want to teach dead white males. They also,
or if they do, there's certain dead white males.
Dead white males.
Because there's intellectual fashion.
That's right. But John Ford Rusher is of a certain generation. Now, I'm of the same generation, so we come with a different background and training, really, than people younger than ourselves in the department. But
although you both have fans and your courses are always, you know,
yes,
Shakespeare, I think Shakespeare and Dickens, leaving aside the dead white male question, I think Shakespeare and Dickens are right now, you know, if you follow intellectual trends, you know, Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker last year, 2 years ago, had a piece called Trollope Trending. Mm-hmm. And it was basically an impassioned plea for Trollope to come back.
Yeah.
Trollope isn't back, though, at least not in this department. I don't think in most English departments.
No, he's back in my home because my wife has begun reading the Barchester novels. She's on Barchester Towers novel too. But anyway, from one point of view, what literature ultimately involves is the encounter of the reader and the text. And that encounter with Toni Morrison can be as satisfying, because Toni Morrison is an excellent writer, and that can be as conducive to the kinds of goals that I outlined earlier as can reading Dickens. What worries me is that if all you read is Toni Morrison, what you may lack is an historical sense. It's good to read Dickens, if only to find out that the workers have been exploited for the last 150
exactly,
years.
Exactly, it's
anyway,
not new.
That there is a lot of things that are not new under the sun. And that, you know, that you take a history course, for example, and you suddenly discover that atrocities were being carried out in the Civil War, being carried out in the Second World War, and you begin to see not that, you know, that in some way you do not live in a unique time.
Right.
And I think that that's the problem. If you focus only on the now, the questions of racial relations in our time, or ethnic and relations in our time, or poverty in our time, one tends to forget that this is an historical question, and as a result, the response one makes to it in an effort to eradicate it might be a little bit different than if you think it's unique.
Because what you were saying before about not only seeing the other but imagining the if, you can imagine a broader, richer if you have all these other examples.
Indeed, that's what I think you would want to say about that. It's important, you know, that George Bernard Shaw at the end of St. Joan, has one of his characters say, you know, do we have to burn a person at the stake every generation so that people know you shouldn't burn people at the stake? And I say, no, you don't. but that's his point. If you know things that have happened in the past, if you understand the past to the extent we can, and imagine and enter into that world imaginatively, then you know.
Then you don't have to actually do the burning.
You don't have to burn the person.
Right.
You know what it means to burn somebody imaginatively. You say, no, that's not something we do.
Do you know this New York Times article that I mentioned earlier about Hillary Clinton's upcoming foreign policy speech? This advisor of hers, Jake Sullivan, was also quoted as saying, does anybody not remember where we were 8 years ago? Like, in other words, you know, just, do we have to burn someone at the stake again?
I mean, the
analogy isn't quite exactly right.
No, but that's true.
It's that, and it's like that old thing that people say about the Holocaust that has become sort of trite, you know, never forget. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, as a sort of atheist Jew, always sort of roll my eyes at that never forget, because it's become a cliche.
Yes.
But there is something to knowing history.
What human beings are capable of.
Right.
And I think if we've learned anything from the Holocaust, we've learned that that's not an aberration.
And, you know, the thing, just you were talking about not being alone, not being in a vacuum. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I had obviously read Shakespeare before your class, but I hadn't read it in such a concentrated way in years. And one of the things that struck me over and over again, and I meant to note this as I read, and I really didn't, but every time that there was a line or an expression that resonated so much with me now, you know, the hate, love, envy, jealousy, you know, and you just think, this is what, 400 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just the atrocities that aren't new, Mm-hmm. It's also just the basic human emotions. Yeah. I mean, it's trite for me to say that to you, right? You know this.
Well,
but...
I don't think it is trite. I think it is that that in some way that's another function of the imagination to, at some level, despite postmodernism and the sense that, you know, we live in a unique and historic moment, that there is something that transcends time that connects people to people.
Right, and I think if you've read Shakespeare or you've read, I'm just starting Sentimental Education, and you know, it you actually then read Diaz in a different way, because Diaz does get to particularities of, you know, the Dominican immigrant experience that Shakespeare doesn't, and there's something to that particularity that's great. It's like the Stephen Greenblatt article looking at Shakespeare in a historical light.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something particular about Shakespeare, but there's also something universal. And the same thing with Diaz, right? I mean, it's the particular and the universal together that are, to me, that's what's so great.
Also, you read the lines, talking about immigrants and so on, read the lines ascribed to Shakespeare in the play Thomas More. You could not read anything more insightful about the treatment of immigrants than those lines. It's about 15 lines or so, and where the speaker, who is Moore, warns the people of the city of London about the consequences of prejudice and taking action against foreigners, aliens.
Mm, mm. I'm going to have to go look for that.
Yeah. That's,
okay, I'm going to let you prepare for your class.
Good. Okay.
Let me
hope that was helpful.
Oh, very helpful. Let me just turn this...